The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy, we examine what really happened to the kids from Covington High School in their visit to Washington, D.C.
This wasn't a demonstration by the pro-life kids. They were waiting for the bus, being harassed by a bunch of anti-white racists.
But the problem is bigger than this single incident.
You give crazy, unstable, nasty, venomous people a keyboard and all hell breaks loose.
Later, Christian schools take the heat for their biblical view of sexuality.
What is the school supposed to say?
And we discuss the vitriol heading towards 2020.
What I'd say is I think what we're in for the next 2 years as the president is either a racist or a racist enabler.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my own program each weekday morning live, 6 a.m. to 9 a.m. Eastern and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com. And let me invite you to join us by video. Over the weekend, Twitter caught fire over what appeared to be a group of high school students harassing an elderly Native American. That was the story from the initial tweet, and nearly every media outlet ran with it, unchecked. It was one of the most irresponsible efforts on the part of the media in modern times. And as media outlets pushed this story along, others tweeted the names and addresses of the kids involved. This effort to make public private information is called doxing, and it spread to family members as well. As more videos surfaced, it became clear that many had all of the story wrong and most had some of it wrong. In fact, often it was the complete opposite of what someone had said. But the damage was done. Death threats were coming at an alarming rate to Covington. Dennis Prager discussed the details of the story with John Zmirak, senior editor of The Stream.
First, the facts. What happened?
Okay. A bunch of kids from an all-boy high school in Kentucky, in Covington, were coming back from the March for Life and apparently were waiting for the bus to pick them up. So they're waiting around by the Lincoln Memorial for their bus to pick them up. A weird cult that calls itself the Black Hebrew Israelites shows up. And the Black Hebrew Israelites are anti-Semitic, anti-white, gay-bashing, vicious, nasty people. They make the Nation of Islam look like the Knights of Columbus. We have them. They appear in Dallas. They used to appear right across the street from my apartment. And I would have to walk past them. They'd be yelling, "Cracker!" and "White Devil!" and "You wait, we're going to kill y'all." I mean, vicious, nasty threats. Anybody who passes by who they think looks gay or Jewish, they will shout slurs at them. So these kids, these pro-life kids, most of them white from Kentucky, were waiting for their bus, getting yelled at by vicious, nasty, hateful, like the black equivalent of the Ku Klux Klan. You don't get much worse than these people. They claim that they are the real Israelites and that people who we would normally identify as Jewish are in fact devil white impersonators pretending to be the God's people. Okay, that's how nasty these folks are. So they've been yelling at it, abusing the pro-life kids. And then this Indian activist, Nathan Phillips, who has a long-time career of getting up in the face of white kids and banging his drum and, you know, aggressively confronting them, he marches over, followed by some other Indians, and he gets in the face of one. He marches like 20, 30 feet from their little demonstration to the white kids, the pro-life kids waiting for the bus.
All right, forgive me. Is there any connection between the Phillips, the Native American crowd, and the Black Hebrew Israelites?
I don't know any organizational connection. They appeared to be having a joint rally, but maybe they just happen to be in the same place. Okay, so it was like 20.
Oh, so that's not clear. It's not clear.
Not clear.
Okay.
It's not clear.
I watched a video, and the these Black Hebrew Israelites, or their leader, kept screaming at the Catholic kids, "Donald Trump is a homosexual."
Yeah. So, also, these black activists were the ones yelling, why don't y'all build a wall? Why don't you build a wall? They were the ones yelling, build a wall, to mock the pro-life kids.
So let me restate in 30 seconds so that I know I have it and that my listeners have it right. So a group of kids from a Catholic school in Covington, Kentucky, were waiting for their bus to take them from the Right to Life March in Washington, D.C. this past weekend. While they were waiting at the bus, a demonstration by a radical anti-Semitic, anti-gay, anti-white group of black Hebrew Israelites, their rally was taking place. Then, as well, a bunch of Native American, radical or not, came, and they started demonstrating, headed by, what is the guy's name again?
Nathan Phillips, and he says he's a veteran from the Vietnam era, but he doesn't say, actually, that he served in Vietnam. We don't even really have any evidence that he served in the military at all. I'd like to see him, like, tell us where and with whom he served. But,
oh, that is interesting. Maybe maybe he's a veteran of the era. He lived through the era, not through.
Or maybe he was a supply sergeant in Oklahoma the whole time, and we just don't know.
All right. Well, if he was, I mean, you know, give him credit.
Yeah,
for
I know,
that.
But I'm just saying it's not.
No,
you know,
I understand.
They're treating him like he's a Purple Heart veteran.
I agree. Well, of course. Okay, so he comes and he demonstrates. I watched the video, and he's banging a drum in 2 inches from the face of this white kid that was wearing a MAGA, Make American Great Again hat. Goes to a Catholic school, and all the kid does the whole time is smile. He doesn't mock the guy. He doesn't speak nothing, correct?
Here's the important thing. The Indian marches 50 feet over and invades the space, like where the white kids, the pro-life kids are waiting. The Indians march into their space. If this were a formal like demonstration, the police would have prevented that. You don't let the opposing sides mix. That's how you get things like Charlottesville. The police are supposed to keep separate opposing demonstrations apart. That's their job. But this wasn't a demonstration by the pro-life kids. They were waiting for the bus, being harassed by a bunch of anti-white racists, and now these Indians march up, and the guy starts banging a drum in his face. Now, what I would like to know is, what was that kid supposed to do? You're standing there waiting for the bus, and some weird old guy comes up and starts banging a drum in your face. What's the correct response? What was he supposed to do? I would like to know the next time some crazy person blows a hunting horn or uses some other tribal instrument from his people and blows it in my face or bangs in my face, what is the polite thing to do? Nobody's
all right. So now the reason I am covering this, as I told my listeners, and this is truly significant, is to point out again that the media lie regularly, on a daily basis almost, on anything that has to do with anything that has to do with politics. They don't lie about earthquakes in Ecuador. That I rely on the mainstream media. But anything that affects their views, they lie.
Go to townhallreview.com for the rest of the discussion and sign up for the podcast. The Twitter storm that targeted the kids and their families is just the latest social media outburst. Salem host Mike Gallagher examines the dangers of this trend.
Let's dive into Covington because, man, this thing has exploded on social media in a way that I have rarely seen a story take wing. This is, of course, the story of the group of kids from Covington High School, the Catholic high school in Covington, Kentucky. So much has been said, so much has been, and my initial reaction was, can we not make the whole news cycle, as we're in the middle of a partial government shutdown, a battle over the wall, race relations challenges, all the things we have in America that we're facing, can we not spend morning, noon, and night on this conflict between these kids wearing their Make America Great Again hats and this Native American named Nathan Phillips? But, you know, a very funny thing happened as this unfolded. There has been a spotlight, an unwanted spotlight, put on the media, the mainstream media that accepts a narrative and runs with it and ruins people's lives. I believe a more important issue has been addressed, and that is the mob mentality of social media, which is, of course, why I hate social media and why I tend to avoid it. I'm not a Twitter fan, not a Facebook fan, and, you know, we're on this radio row, and all these great broadcasters, I know they have their signs, and they've got their Twitter, and I do, too. We've got to kind of do it. The Twitter mob will destroy you. They will absolutely eviscerate people. They'll attack families. They will dox you, which means you have this entire community of people revealing where a kid's mom works, where his dad works. Kathy Griffin wanting names, journalists wanting kids killed. That's what happens when a man is in his boxer shorts in the basement of his mom's home in front of a computer keyboard. That's what happens. You give crazy, unstable, nasty, venomous people a keyboard and all hell breaks loose. And I've been talking about it for year after year after year. It can be a wonderful tool, I'm sure. You can connect to people you didn't know and haven't seen in 20 years. Oh, look, there's Bobby from the class of 78. How you been, Bobby? And meanwhile, the Covington High School in Kentucky is now shut down. So you got kids not getting an education. You got terrified kids. You have parents who are afraid of losing their jobs because of the threats, because of the mob. And that, to me, is the most important takeaway. You know what's happened here? There's this shaming that goes on. And let me be honest. I'm a rock rib conservative. I'm a Trump supporter. I want him to win. I want this country to succeed. I'm a Second Amendment guy. I'm pretty basic. I'm a pretty simple, basic guy. Let's face some facts here. The shaming has gone on both ways in this story. This has been a two-way street. And I don't know that it's all that good. This is the way it started on Friday. And jump on board and join me on this, because we got a lot of territory to cover this hour as we bring you here to Vegas and the ReliefFactor.com studios, the sixth annual visit from the Mike Gallagher Show to the Big Shot Show. Let's be clear. Let's make sure that factually we're correct. On Friday, this video went viral. Kids, you know, standing there looking at the Native American who waded into the crowd. He's banging the drum in the kid's face, and the kid didn't back down. The kid stood there, held his ground. There were no chants that anybody heard on tape, build the wall. The guy didn't. There's all kinds of questions now about the Native American and his veracity. Did he really serve in Vietnam? Is he an actor? Is he a former actor? So all this crap is going on, right? First cycle, the kids are bigots. They need to be drawn and quartered. Let's take care of them. Then the longer video emerges. It's not quite the way it seems. Wait a minute. You mean the Native American waded into the crowd? Oh, wait a minute. You mean there's these four black Israelite terror scary guys that are threatening these kids? Oh, it's not quite as it appears. So then the media backs off. CNN backs off. New York Times backs off. Washington Post backs off.
Our program is coming in today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They are preparing grounded leaders who are impacting public policy and serving in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up,
what is the school supposed to say?
The fun of 2020 when the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. When Karen Pence announced her plan to return to teaching at the Christian school where she worked before, one might expect the media to find it a bit touching. Imagine having the wife of the Vice President of the United States teaching your children. But that's not how the media handled this one. Almost immediately, headlines focused not on her teaching or on the school itself, but instead on the fact that the school actually teaches the historic Christian faith. The New York Times headline reads, Karen Pence is teaching at a Christian school that bars LGBT students and teachers. Nearly every other one had a variation of that. Some accuse the school of hatred. My friend and colleague Dennis Prager explains the issue in question.
They believe that the Bible wants a man and a woman to bond, to marry, and to have sex within marriage. That doesn't hate anybody. But if you advocate a different attitude in life, Listen, I am against same-sex marriage, and as I always point out, I am the godfather to the to two children of a gay couple. I do not see why they are in any way in conflict. So that's the headline, CNN, Karen Pence goes to school which bans gays. To the best of my knowledge, the school does not ask you what your sexual orientation is. If you, however, start to speak about it and offer it as a valid option, or not option, just a valid way of living, then within the Christian context of the school, they how could the school say okay? What is the school supposed to say? I suspect that an Orthodox Jewish school where parents would be advocating homosexuality, it could be wonderful people. The issue isn't are you wonderful. The issue is there are principles. I suspect that if a heterosexual couple is not married and advocates, look, we're bonded, but we're not married, I'm sure that they would have a problem with that at the Christian school. But here is what is particularly of interest to me. This is of particular interest. If Michelle Obama were first lady, or if you will, Mrs. Biden, okay, this is the vice president's wife. Let's be precise. Mrs. Biden would go and teach at a school that said to the children, you are not necessarily a boy or a girl. I was told by parents of kids in a school that they were told, if you today identify as a boy, then we're going to be doing this. If you identify as a girl, to kids who were 7, 8 years old. Now, if there would be no headline in CNN, Mrs. Biden teaches at school that tells boys and girls that they can choose whether to be a boy or a girl. Which, do you think that that's damaging to children? For adults to tell them with all seriousness, if you identify as a boy, then we do X. If you identify as a girl, and if you don't identify as either, as non-binary, then you'll let us know. That's fine, too. I consider that child abuse, but CNN does not. CNN thinks it's progressive to tell children that they choose whether to be a boy or a girl. This experiment by the left on a generation of children is new in human history. It is not just new in American history. To tell children you are not a boy or a girl unless you choose to be so, and you may choose otherwise a year from now. I pity this generation because of the left. I do. I pity them. You're a boy who acts like a boy? Toxic masculinity. That's what the American Psychological Association, which has been thoroughly corrupted by leftism. There is no, remember, to understand modern life, you need to understand everything the left touches, it ruins.
The run-up to 2020 is underway. Many candidates have already announced. Others are testing the waters. And there is already a message coming from the Democratic Party. I discussed this with David Drucker, senior political correspondent for the Washington Examiner, when he joined me on the Hugh Hewitt Show.
We had Joe Biden riffing on race. Listen to this from Joe Biden.
We've learned in the last 2 years, it doesn't take much to awaken hate, to bring those folks out from under the rocks, that part of American society that's always been there, will always be there.
Okay, so, David Drucker, is this what we're in for the next 2 years? America is a racist. The president is a racist. They're under the rocks.
Well,
go ahead.
What I'd say is I think what we're in for the next 2 years is the president is either a racist or a racist enabler. And while I don't think a majority of voters are going to believe that the president's a racist, I do think, and I don't think Republicans should discount this, and this is just what I discovered on the trail in 2018, that there's a lot of anxiety in the country about social upheaval and how they believe some voters in the middle and definitely on the left believe that the president has created an environment for a lot of this stuff to be more open. Now, I am not saying any of this is true, but I don't think Republicans should out of hand dismiss this as crazy talk that will have no appeal. And voters are sophisticated enough to say, I don't think the president is bad as they say, but I do think the president hasn't made things any better. And I think Republicans and the president, as he's running for reelection, need to look out for that sentiment and not just laugh it off.
Well, you know, I'm going to disagree with you here. I think if they run on racism, they're going to get rejected by the country because the country isn't racist.
I don't actually think at the end of the day the Democratic nominee is going to run on that the country is racist. I think that they're going to try and make the case that the president looks the other way and helps create an environment. And what I'm saying is not that it's true. It's that it shouldn't be dismissed as nobody will buy into that, because there is a lot of anxiety in the country about social upheaval. And it's not just on the right. It's also on the left. And people in the middle, I think, just want things to feel normal. And I just think it's something that Republicans have to look out for and not welcome as this will obviously help us win, because voters will just know that they're crazy.
The general is a long way away. But I do think if the Republican presidential carnival of 2016 was all about 16 people trying to stop one person, this is going to be about 40 people trying to get to the left of each other. That creates a very interesting dynamic, David Drucker. In all seriousness, I don't know how far left you can go.
Well, that is going to be really interesting, because you have a look. They all basically are going to agree on policy for the most part. So I'm curious to see how they're going to try and differentiate themselves on foreign policy, and whether they're going to try and differentiate themselves all that much from the president on foreign policy. That to me is going to tell you a lot, I think, about what the middle decides to do once you eventually have a nominee, but also what independent voters might do in those states where you can participate in Democratic primaries. And I do think, by the way, that a lot of these Democratic candidates, a lot of them, other than maybe a Biden, are going to have to stake out some ground on national security.
Coming up.
It has to do with a personal vitriol that they have against this president that is vastly different and unproportional to anything that we've ever seen in any vast White House.
Former Press Secretary Sean Spicer, when the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt continues in a moment. If you enjoy the Town Hall Review and you are a person of faith, let me introduce you to another podcast I think you'll like. It's the Christian Outlook, and in it you'll hear the leading voices in the Christian world engaging the issue of the day. This week, you'll hear David French talking about the growing hostility towards Christians here in the U.S.
You can be the most kind-hearted, most winsome Christian around, and there will be still people who hate you if you still hold to orthodox Christian positions on sexuality and gender identity.
To subscribe, go to ChristianOutlook.com. That's ChristianOutlook.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. The Covington High School story swallowed up the media controversy that took place just days before it occurred, when a BuzzFeed article accused President Trump of telling his then-attorney, Michael Cohen, to lie to Congress. That story was widely circulated, although to their credit, most pundits added the caveat, if true. Then special counsel Robert Mueller, in an unusual move, distanced himself from that claim. That pretty much killed the story. Salem host Sebastian Gorka discussed the story with former White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer.
And we have a cut about the accusations of the president and Russia that I think you will enjoy.
If this BuzzFeed news report is true, then we are likely on our way to possible impeachment proceedings.
Because if this story is true, it means that Donald Trump, as president, suborned perjury and essentially orchestrated a scheme to lie to a co-equal branch of government.
If this BuzzFeed news report is...
Because if this story is true...
If the heart of the story is true,
it's out there.
If... Is that journalism? It's not even reportage. I can think of none better to give us his wisdom on what has happened to the media than Sean Spicer. Sean, I think you heard this story of my little contretemps with a certain Abilio Jim Acosta. Have you managed to miss that story?
I cannot escape them. So I have seen it. And I got to be honest with you, I was a little taken back. You know, I'm not really sure that someone of his nature that has dealt with so much criticism of how he's conducted himself is in a position to just come right out and start whacking at other people who haven't done anything to deserve it.
But I never met the guy. I mean, I never broke bread with him. I never sat down with him. The first time he was within a foot of me when he grabbed my arm in front of witnesses and said, "You're not supposed to be here. This is for journalists," in the White House press briefing room that was your home.
You're a radio host. You're in the briefing room where the press hangs out. From what I understand, happened. But there's countless radio hosts. There's TV hosts. There's columnists. I don't know. And I also who gave him the right to call balls and strikes and determine
Jim
who's
did.
A journalist and who's not? And like you said, I think the important part is you never did say you were. You're a radio host and a commentator. And I think, frankly, the irony is at least you're honest about what you are. Maybe he's not as honest, him trying to call himself a journalist as opposed to a pundit and a YouTube star.
Yeah, which he is. I don't know how you didn't physically do something to this man, because he really thought it was the Jim Acosta show when he was in the press briefing room with you. Sean, the media's not getting any better, is it?
No. In fact, it's getting worse. And I think, look, this is a topic that's worthy of, like, you know, its own show.
Yeah.
The media, number one, remember, is a business, which you know, meaning that these folks are catering to an audience that they want to grow, that they need to click, that there is in greater competition with because of podcasts and the proliferation of so much stuff on the web. So to forget that it is a business is to misunderstand exactly what's going on. That's number one. Number two is when you look at all of the studies that have come out, you realize that it has become, it's not just bifurcated. It's not like the right and the left. You have 90%+, depending on the study, that has realized that this is very personal and vitriol. And where the press would have you set up a fake argument is to say, our job is to be tough. Our job is to ask the tough questions. I agree with all that, and I think you probably do too.
Yeah.
This has nothing to do with being tough. This has nothing to do with asking tough questions. It has to do with a personal vitriol that they have against this president that is vastly different and unproportional to anything that we've ever seen in any vast White House. I expect these guys to be tough and critical, but I don't expect them to make it visceral and personal.
What would Sean Spicer say now, given the insanity, the increased insanity of the left and the press? What are your words of wisdom to the team that's there now and the president as we are in the 28th day of this shutdown? What are Sean Spicer's words of wisdom?
Well, look, I think that the president is doing what he needs to be doing in terms of making his case. I think that the more that he understands visuals and using the office better than anybody probably in history. My advice only to them would be do more and do it as often, right? So talk directly to the American people. He's made a bunch of videos. He's gotten out there. Keep doing that. But also, I think to the extent that you can get outside the White House and go visit people, I think his visit to the border was excellent. He really needs to continue to visually explain to people what the problem is that he is seeking to solve, what the concerns are that he has. And the more that they can demonstrate that visually by getting outside of the White House, bringing folks in, sitting around a bunch of tables is good because, you know, you get these snippets. But getting people to visualize what's actually happening on the border, the humanitarian concerns the president has, the drugs that are flowing over there, really kind of getting out there and allowing that story to get more exposed, I think is critical. So I would say do what you're doing, but do more of it.
Our program is coming today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up,
people who are closest to problems are in the best position to solve them.
Gene Case, when the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. brought to you in partnership with ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. Jean Case is a risk taker. Many of her efforts have paid off. Some have not. She discusses both in her book, Be Fearless, Five Principles for a Life of Breakthroughs and Purpose. She is the first female chairman of the National Geographic Society in its 130-year history. She is delightful, articulate, and humble, especially for someone who has accomplished all that she has. She joined me on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Embedded in Be Fearless is a little history of the National Geographic Society, and that's one of the many reasons to get that. When you started out to write Be Fearless, did you intend, I'm going to get the National Geographic Society story in here somewhere?
Yeah, well, it really has inspired me. I mean, the fearlessness and risk-taking is in the DNA of the National Geographic Society, and there's fearless men and women on the front lines, you know, doing great stuff around the globe. So, yes, I couldn't write a book called Be Fearless and not talk about my beloved National Geographic Society.
All right, now, I got to tell you, this is why I'm going to start here. My great-grandparents were German-Americans who ran the Hotel Ashtabula in Ashtabula, Ohio. So when I read about Ernest and Anna Baumgarten, I said, I got to ask Jean Case about this, because you were bait. I think you refer to yourself as bait at the counter in the hotel.
That's right. I write about being born in the town of Normal, Illinois. And my German immigrant grandparents, like yours, ran a hotel in town. And yes, they would put me behind the counter because they realized if I was with my grandmother behind the counter, customers would buy more. And she realized, hey, they're just being nice to the kids, so spend more time back here with me. And so we did.
It's a good story. I also want to talk about Norma Norton, your mom. And here's why. There are a lot of people listening this morning who are single moms with four kids who are struggling. And that had to be your mom when she moved you from Normal down to Florida. And look at you now. And so if they look at their kids, the Be Fearless book will inspire them.
You know, that really is my hope for the book. But I must say, yes, I was the youngest of four kids raised by a single mom. You know, our first principle in the book is make a big bet. And I realized I was her big bet in life. And, you know, how fortunate was I to have a hardworking mom, worked as a waitress at night, just to provide opportunities for me, and the generosity of others as well. But the real reason I wrote the book, Hugh, is because, you know, my work has taken me around the country and around the world, and I see that ordinary people everywhere have great ideas about how to make the world a better place. But they sometimes get stuck thinking they can't be the one to take the idea forward. They think they need special genius or graduating from the right school or whatever it is. So at the Case Foundation, which I run, we did some research 6 years ago to look at the core qualities of people who break through and do great things. And what we discovered were these five principles that I write about in the book. But more importantly, we could debunk this idea that you have to have some superhuman special quality. In fact, people who are closest to problems are in the best position to solve them. And that's really the message of the book. I tried to bring the principles alive through storytelling of people you've heard of and people you've never heard of, and talk about how they had failures and challenges along the way, too, but they kept at it.
You know, I've read a lot of books like this, but what I think distinguishes Be Fearless is that the pace with which you move through the stories is appropriate to the age in which we live. But if I had a high school, you know, my granddaughter can read, but she's only seven. When she's 10, she's going to read this, because I want, you know, there are a lot of them are women, but a lot of them are just all over the place about, I mean, just simple things like Thomas Edison being a fast and effective follower. Not, I mean, he's a genius, but he's a fast and effective follower. You can start where you are and start following other people.
I love that, Hugh. You're exactly right. And, of course, that's the first chapter, the opening of the book, is start right where you are. And I tell a great story about a woman, Dr. Barbara Van Dalen, who was, you know, a sole practitioner doing mental health counseling when the Iraq and Afghanistan wars were raging. And listen, military families needed some mental health support during those years, and we didn't have capacity in the nation through our Veterans Administration and military to help them out. So Barbara started doing one free hour for families a week, and then she got this idea. What if I created a national network to do this? She set out as one person. She didn't even have an assistant when she got started, as one person, and created a national network of thousands of doctors who came together and provided mental health counseling services for military and their families. And today, they've given over $25 million in free healthcare services. Great perfect example of someone who just said, what do I have that I can bring to the table and make a difference? And look at the difference she made. And Time named her among the 100 most influential people in the world after she did this, just recognizing the impact she had as one individual.
I had not known her story, and I was very impressed. I do know the story because I know Jake Wood. In fact, the only I keep very few awards that are given to me. I have two in my studio, one from Semper Fi Fund and one from Team Rubicon. And I knew Clay. So when you talk about Jake and Clay and Team Rubicon, I realize that they are now big and everywhere. But they didn't start that way. They had very humble beginnings.
Yeah, it's another great military story, of course, realizing that when our servicemen and women come home, you know, they go from sort of being called on to do great, bold things every day to sort of just living, you know, a normal life. And many of them wanted to continue their service. So obviously they do that in disaster relief today. And it's another great story of just taking what you have and saying, you know, the people I know, the skills I have, how can I make a difference in this world? And that's what Team Rubicon has done, and it's been great.
I want to compliment you as well and be fearless. No sugarcoating. Sometimes you're going to do a face plant. Play Pumps may be the most important story in Be Fearless, so I want you to tell it and why you included it, because a lot of authors wouldn't have the courage to include that.
Yeah, well, I can't write a book with one principle called make failure matter and not acknowledge my own failures. That just wouldn't be very authentic. And that failure was very public for me. The idea of make failure matter is, obviously, if you're trying to do great things, you're going to fail along the way, you know, stare failure and fear in the eye and keep moving. So for me, it was a very public failure of a clean water initiative that we had launched with President Clinton to my right and First Lady Laura Bush to my left to bring clean water to villages across Africa. And we did this for a couple of years. We had a lot of partners. It was very exciting work, but then it started running into some issues, and we realized, okay, we've got to course correct. So we worked on that for about a year. Finally, we realized it was a failing initiative. So I wrote a blog called The Painful Acknowledgement of Coming Up Short, in which I acknowledged the failure of the initiative. And I was surprised by what happened, Hugh, and it really began this Be Fearless workforce. People called and wrote me and reached out and said, thank you for acknowledging failure, because we don't do that enough in this world.
The rest of that interview is available only at townhallreview.com. While you're there, sign up for the podcast and get a daily dose of the best in conservative talk radio. Let me add a specific invitation here. We're going to be doing more exclusive interviews in the days to come, stuff you'll only get if you subscribe to our podcast. I'm excited to extend an invitation to you. Join us, or let me join you on your handheld device. Go to townhallreview.com. I want to talk to you for a moment about a group I've done work with for years, ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. You've seen how your freedom is under attack, but if you act now, you can protect your family today and generations to come. Go to townhallreview.com to find out how you can join Alliance Defending Freedom to help ensure the opponents of freedom don't dictate your future. That's townhallreview.com. Coming up,
we have two imperatives going on. One is the instantaneous nature of viral videos and the internet and Twitter, and then we have what journalism is supposed to be, and sometimes they're really in conflict.
That's Jake Tapper talking about the role of an anchor in an era of breaking news, which can sometimes be very, very wrong. When we return to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Jake Tapper is my friend. We did a couple of presidential debates together in 2016. He's a frequent guest on my radio show. So I wanted to ask him, what exactly is it like to be an anchor on television in an era of breaking news, which has occasionally turned out to be breaking exactly in the wrong direction? First of all, Jake Tapper hosts The Lead and State of the Union, and if you watch Jake, you'll know the name Shannon Kent, Scott Wirtz, Jonathan Farmer, and Ghadir Tahir, because those are the four Americans killed in Syria. I always appreciate, Jake Tapper, that you pay attention to these stories. A lot of people don't.
Yeah, I mean, I wish I could say I've been doing it throughout my journalistic career, but the awareness of paying more attention to service members, including those in the diplomatic and intelligence corps, came after I wrote the book, The Outpost, about Afghanistan. And then, you know, we just don't give enough attention to who these people are. And as you noted, four of these individuals killed in Syria, and two of them were women and two of them were non-service members. They were with DIA. One was a contractor. One of them had a very inspiring story, an immigrant from the Middle East, came to the United States, wanted to help her country, et cetera. And, you know, we know the names of all the Kardashians, but we don't know the names of these people who do so much for us.
So covering the right things is part of my question, which you do. Now covering the wrong things. At least what I wanted to ask you as an anchor, I do it here with the help of Dwayne. We live in an age of viral video and breaking news rules. What have you done after Covington Catholic? Have you done anything with your team to try and somehow filter or slow down the cycle, which is almost impossible to do?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, I have not covered it on air, Covington Catholic. And, you know, I have a show on Sunday morning, so we could have mentioned it on air. We could have asked our guests about it or asked our panel about it. But at the time, I just didn't think we knew enough about what had happened. At that point, we hadn't even heard from anybody associated with Covington Catholic as to their perspective. And we have two imperatives going on. One is the instantaneous nature of viral videos and the Internet and Twitter. And then we have what journalism is supposed to be. And sometimes they're really in conflict. The truth of the matter is that I think people in journalism, including myself, especially myself, need to, you know, we need to stand by the finished product that we do, which is vetting and sources. And, you know, it might not be first. It might not even be in the top 20 in terms of responding to a story that's breaking. But we need to get it right. And that's more important. And I think the viral videos, I know I get that there's a pressure to cover it, to respond to it, to tweet about it. But I think ultimately I side with Farhad Manjoo, who has a piece in the Times, which is like it's actually the opposite of what we do in journalism. So I myself have taken some lessons from this, although, you know, I haven't stated opinion about Covington. I've just shared a lot of stories about it from left, right, center and news analysis. But even doing that, I think people get upset because the first 10 versions of a story aren't necessarily the most thoroughly vetted ones.
Thanks for joining us for this edition of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Schubin and producers Charlie Richards, David Posey and Michael Cook, Adam Ramsey and Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsors, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. Thank you for joining us.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.